Power on.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Pop Culture Retro-Rama Podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and I'm here to share memories, thoughts, and information on all manner of retro-related properties. Movies.
Are you telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Music.
I want my MTV. All right.
Comic books.
These ain't your daddy's comic books, fanboy.
And toys.
It's Castle Grayskull. And it's mine.
Broadcasting to you from the depths of the Pop Culture Retrorama Vault. So, come join us, won't you?
Now, you're playing with power.
Friends, thank you for joining us once again for an episode of the Pop Culture Retrorama Podcast. As hinted at in the last episode, on this show I'm going to be discussing 1980s cult musical comedy, The Blues Brothers. First of all, I apologize, but this episode was a little late because work kind of has a way to gum up my podcasting plans on a regular basis. And before I begin the dive into The Blues Brothers, I'd like to point out that I have started up a brand new website, spun off of the former Retroist site. Not only a place where I can upload new episodes of this show, or Diary of an Arcade Employee and the Saturday Frights podcast, among others, but to continue to share my love of pop culture and all things retro. It's easy enough to find, as the new site has been named after this very podcast. So, you can look it up at www.popculturetrorama.com. I have been joined by more than a few fellow writers from the Retroist site, like Allison Vinicio Preston, Rob Flack O'Hara, IC Robots, and Earl Green, to name a few. I also hope that at some point, the Retroist might even join us on the pop culture site now and again. Now, I think it's time that we straighten our black razor ties and adjust our fedoras, and make sure that we are wearing our vintage Wayfarer Ray-Ban sunglasses as we prepare to visit Sweet Home Chicago as we talk about 1980's The Blues Brothers. I first saw The Blues Brothers at the 62 Drive-In Theater, a magical spot that I've talked about on not just this podcast, but quite a bit on the Saturday Frights podcast. I really did luck out getting to see many of the films there that I still hold dear, even if sometimes I might have been too young to see them. Some would say that would be the case for The Blues Brothers, as I was 8 years old when it was released on June 20th of 1980. Although, as I've shared before, in many cases, if my father wanted to see a movie, he really had no other option than to take me too. In fact, in an interview on Chud.com, John Landis in the past said, in part of the interview, quote, "It's all slapstick. There's nothing in it I wouldn't let an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old see. There's a lot of profanity in it. That's why it's R-rated." End quote. Considering the colorful metaphors that my dad would unleash when angered, I had probably heard worse than what was present in the film itself by that point in my young life. I can tell you that when the Blues Brothers played at the 62 Drive-In, it was well received, judging by the amount of laughter that could be heard that night. For good reason, too. While I had never seen the Blues Brothers on Saturday Night Live at that point, I believe both John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd had left the show by the time of the movie. I do remember how amazing it was to see my father cackling, just slapping the steering wheel as he watched the deadpan antics of Elwood and the over-the-top stunts of Jake. Portrayed, of course, by Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. The Blues Brothers also instilled in me a love of musicals, and even an admiration for Chicago's blues music. Not that I realized at 8 years old that was what I was listening to. Although, I did know of Ray Charles thanks to my grandmother. I spent many a morning listening to some of his records as a kid. Although Ray Charles' cover of the Five Deutones' 1963 song Shake a Tail Feather would probably be not only one of my favorite moments in the film, but also my favorite song. Thanks to the soundtrack, I was introduced to the music of Aretha Franklin, John Lee Hooker, and Cab Calloway, to point out a few. Some real powerhouses in music. And that is saying something, because the movie really does have an amazing soundtrack. The truth of the matter is, the film has an embarrassment of riches in who appears and performs, as well as the members that make up the Blues Brothers band. This is an excellent spot to talk about how the movie came to be, which, from by all accounts, was thanks to the suggestion of the late and great Carrie Fisher, who was dating Dan Aykroyd at the time. You see, the Blues Brothers sort of began back in 1973. In November, in fact, at the 505 Club, which was located in Toronto. Or, as oral history goes, sometimes it was in 1974. The thing is, the 505 Club was a place for the Second City performers to relax. The 505 Club was also the place that Dan Aykroyd called home, along with his brother Peter. It's been noted that the likes of Jack Nicholson, legendary composer and original SNL band director Howard Shore, as well as ZZ Top, Mick Jagger, and even director Francis Ford Coppola, had been spotted in the club, and Coppola apparently even served as an impromptu bartender. And whether it was in 1973 or 1974, I believe it's safe to say that fate came calling when, on a snowy evening, John Belushi, while in town on business, happened to hear a recording of Down Child Blues Band's 1973 album Straight Up at the 505 Club.
Every day I had the blues. Every day, baby, every day I had the blues. When you see me worry, woman, it's who I hate to lose. Nobody loved me. Nobody seemed to care. Nobody loved me. Nobody seemed to care.
That was a clip from Every Day I Have the Blues. The Down Child Blues Band was co-founded by two brothers, Donnie and Richard Walsh. I think that is Richard on the lead vocals in that tune, by the way. I mention this as it has been said that Dan Aykroyd would use the two brothers as the basis for Joliet, Jake, and Elwood Blues. And considering that three of the songs from Straight Up appeared on the Blues Brothers 1978 album, Briefcase Full of Blues, that rumor is probably true. Anyway, John Belushi, who was part of the Second City troupe located in Chicago, was in town trying to find talent for the National Lampoon Radio Hour. He was hoping to get the likes of the legendary Gilda Radner, as well as Aykroyd, to come back with him to Chicago. I suppose Belushi learned of the 505 Club thanks to hanging out after a performance of the Toronto Second City. So, later at the club, John apparently liked what he was hearing from the record in the jukebox and asked Dan who it was playing. After Aykroyd told him, he made a comment about how Belushi must have been a fan of the blues because he hailed from Chicago. It turns out, however, that John was more of a rock and roll guy, but I've read little snippets of interviews online where he had said by the time he stepped foot into the 505 Club, he had begun to tire of it, and he really disliked disco. So, it was the perfect time for him to strike up a new friendship with Dan and dive into the world of the blues. And while John wasn't able to recruit Dan at that point, with Gilda Radner, the trio would of course end up being part of the original Not Ready for Primetime Players, who appeared in Lorne Michaels' late-night sketch comedy Saturday Night Live, joining the likes of Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin, and Garrett Morris. Although it should be noted that Chase was hired to a one-year deal as a writer, as he refused to sign a performer's contract, which was why he was able to leave after 1976, and was replaced by Bill Murray. It's been said that during that first hanging out at the 505 Club, that was where the idea for the Blues Brothers actually began. And I've read online that it was Howard Shore who suggested both Belushi and Aykroyd call themselves the Blues Brothers. During that chat that one snowy night at the club is when Aykroyd revealed he was pretty gifted with a harmonica, and Belushi was no stranger to the drums. It was also the evening, or early morning I should say, since the 505 Club didn't open its doors until 1 a.m, where Dan floated the basic idea of what Jake and Elwood would become. Blues performers with a criminal past, they were never quite on the straight and narrow, no matter how many times they had been incarcerated. The Blues Brothers, as we know them, didn't make their appearance until after Aykroyd and Belushi were hired on SNL. I mean, they really did appear in clubs around town as the Blues Brothers. And while wiser folks than myself had pointed out that John Belushi may not have been the greatest singer, he was, hands down though, an exceptional performer, giving it his all. Apparently, Belushi and Aykroyd attempted to get the characters on Saturday Night Live, but Lorne Michaels was resistant to the idea. Although, he did let them perform before the taping of the shows for the audience as a warm-up act to get everyone's mood up. The concept for the look of the Blues Brothers, by the way, was thanks to Aykroyd. I found on Wikipedia that in an interview from 1988 with the Chicago Sun-Times, he mentioned that some of the act was inspired by the R&B duo Sam and Dave. He said, quote, "Well, obviously the duo thing and the dancing, but the hats came from John Lee Hooker. The suits came from the concept that when you were a jazz player in the 40s, 50s, 60s, to look straight, you had to wear a suit." End quote. It was on January 17th, 1976, that the Blues Brothers would make their first appearance in a musical skit on Saturday Night Live, although they happened to be wearing the Killer Bee suits they had worn the previous week when Elliot Gould was the guest host. It would be 2 years after that skit, in 1978, that the characters of Jake and Elwood Blues would be seen on SNL proper, with their rendition of Dossie Terry and Floyd Dixon's Hey Bartender. Steve Martin happened to be the guest host that evening, which is probably what led to the Blues Brothers having a chance to open for his show at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles, which, as you can imagine, was a pretty big thing for both Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. Steve Martin was huge at the time. There was a teensy-tiny little roadblock the duo would have to overcome for this to happen, though. They needed a band. A real band that could follow them around on gigs. Enter Paul Schaefer. Yes, the very same Schaefer you enjoyed co-hosting with David Letterman. He was a member of the house band with SNL at that time, and with his aid, the Blues Brothers band began to be formed, with bass guitarist Donald Duck Dunn, who had recorded with Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, and Elvis Presley. They also obtained Tom Bones Malone, who could play trombone and saxophone, flute, tuba, clarinet, and had worked with Frank Zappa, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and also happened to be a member of the SNL house band, as was Blue Lou Marini, who was the saxophonist of the band, and had also worked with Frank Zappa. Drummer Steve Gitwa Jordan, too, was a member of the SNL house band, and would go on to work with Paul Schaefer again as part of his World's Most Dangerous Band for David Letterman. Schaefer brought in Steve the Colonel Copper, who had worked with Dunn previously as part of Booker T and the MGs. Steve played guitar and had recorded on Otis Redding's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, and even the hit tune Soul Man with Sam and Dave. And Schaefer also managed to snag Matt Guitar Murphy, who was a blues guitarist, as you could guess, and had worked with the likes of Ike Turner, Etta James, and Memphis Slim. It sounds like the addition of Alan Mr. Fabulous Rubin was at the behest of Belushi. He thought the Blues Brothers band really needed a strong trumpet player, and Rubin fit that bill, and had recorded with artists such as Frank Sinatra, Billy Joel, Miles Davis, and Dr. John, to name a few. Of course, Paul the Shiv Schaefer provided backing vocals, piano, and organ, as well as acting as the musical director. So, the Blues Brother band was set. And by the time the band opened for Steve Martin in September of 1978, Animal House had already hit theaters and been a huge hit, making John Belushi an even bigger draw. In fact, their performance at the Universal Amphitheater was recorded on the night of September 9th. That was the Blues Brothers' first album, Briefcase Full of Blues.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Universal Amphitheater. Well, here it is, the late 1970s going on in 1985. You know, here today is pre-programmed electronic disco. It's so rare we get a chance to see master blues men practicing their craft. So while we still can, let us welcome from Calumet City, Illinois, the band of Joliet, Jake, and Elwood Blues, the Blues Brothers.
That album reached number one on Billboard's 200 and sold 3.5 million copies and went double platinum. The band opened for the Grateful Dead on New Year's Eve of 1978. Think about it for a second. Belushi was in a hit TV show, in a number one film, and had a number one album. So it only seemed logical that with the popularity that a movie be made, right? It was Universal Studios that ponied up the money for the Blues Brothers film. Although, I've read that Paramount Pictures almost won the rights to make the movie. Director John Landis was brought in to helm the picture since he and Belushi had worked on Animal House. Now all that needed to be hammered out was the script and the budget for the movie. And this is where things immediately started to get complicated. I've read online that after 6 months, Dan Aykroyd delivered a screenplay to producer Robert K. Weiss. That was 324 pages long. The actor had never read nor written a screenplay before, and knew it was rather unwieldy, so he had it delivered in between the front and back cover of the Los Angeles Yellow Pages. The reason for its length was not just how it was written, but it really went into the history of Jake and Elwood, as well as each of the musicians and how they were inducted into the band. It was John Landis that was picked to try to whittle down that tome of a screenplay into something that could be made into a feature film. It apparently took him 2 to 3 weeks to deliver his version of the screenplay, which was more in line with the $12 million budget that Universal felt was appropriate for the production. Although, to be honest, Landis, Aykroyd, and Belushi were thinking the budget should be somewhere around $20 million. There was another hitch. Steve Jordan couldn't appear in the film, so Willie Too Big Hall was brought in as the band's drummer. He had recorded with the likes of Isaac Hayes, so he seemed a rather good choice. But the film also lost Paul Schaefer. And I've read online a couple of different reasons for Schaefer having to step away from the production. Contract issues with SNL have been cited, as has working with an album with Gilda Radner or Aretha Franklin, something that supposedly John Belushi felt proved that Schaefer wasn't loyal to the band. I have no idea which is the real reason, but at the very least, he was able to make an appearance in 1998's Blues Brothers 2000. Further stress during the production occurred when Dan Aykroyd insisted that certain notable blues and soul performers were given acting parts in the film, which, I'm sure in the actor's mind, made sense, as they would coincide with musical numbers. Personally, I feel the film proves that he made the right choice of hiring Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Cab Calloway, and James Brown. Apparently, Franklin and Brown would have some issues during the filming as they weren't used to lip-syncing. Brown just performed live during the filming of his scene, and John Landis would basically cut Franklin's respect number so that it would work in the finished film, which is why that segment feels so heavy-handed in regards to editing. As for location, as Aykroyd mentioned to Belushi on that fateful night in 1973, it had to be Chicago, although some scenes were shot in Los Angeles. There was a problem there as well. In the excellent and incredibly informative documentary entitled The Stories Behind the Making of the Blues Brothers, it was revealed that former Chicago mayor Richard J. Daley had banned film and television shows from shooting in the city while he was in office, with Landis saying it had a little something to do with a Lee Marvin TV series called M Squad, which had the iconic actor heading up a squad to combat rampant crime in Chicago. Thankfully for the filmmakers, the 50th mayor of Chicago and the first woman to be elected mayor of a major city in the U.S., Jane Byrne, was more agreeable to the Blues Brothers being filmed in her city. That included allowing the filmmakers to drive the Bluesmobile into the lobby of the state office building in Daley Plaza. In the end, I've read that the Blues Brothers production put about $12 million into the coffers of the city of Chicago, which is not bad at all. In addition, I've heard that the then-mayor, Jane Byrne, had John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd promise to donate $50,000 to charity after filming on the Blues Brothers had wrapped. Thanks to that same documentary, I was incredibly surprised to learn they were able to block off the elevated train line so that they could drive down the street at 118 miles per hour. Those scenes weren't sped up or used any film tricks. In fact, Landis, after watching the first cut of those scenes, felt that audiences would assume he had done something to speed it up, so they positioned stunt people as pedestrians so you could see they were really driving that fast. Problems would sadly continue to plague the filming of the Blues Brothers. Probably most notable was the drug addiction of John Belushi, the result of which caused the film to lose precious time with delays. Even after shooting began, and a budget of $17.5 million was the goal, it was evident very early on that there was no way it was going to come in at that budget. After filming had wrapped, it cost around $27 to $30 million, which I believe was the most money spent on a musical at that point in time, although it eventually earned $115 million. I'm going to go ahead and stop the discussion of problems with the filming, although I will add a link on this podcast post on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. You see, I found an excellent article from Vanity Fair from back in 2013 by Ned Zaman that goes way, way in depth with all manner of issues on the studio's end as well as with the cast and crew. I want to switch over to the brief synopsis now for the Blues Brothers, because I want this show to focus on the legacy that was crafted by the actors, musicians, as well as John Landis and his crew, a film that continues to gain new admirers over the years, that provided us with a John Landis pen line, "We're on a mission from God," to the universal hatred of Illinois Nazis, and the fact that Bob's Country Bunker plays both kinds of music, country and western. As always, I will try to add some interesting trivia where I can. As the Blues Brothers begins, Jake is being released from prison, the Joliet Correctional Facility. He served 3 years of his 5-year prison sentence and has been paroled for good behavior. After reclaiming his possessions from the Muppets' Frank Oz, who's playing a corrections officer, he is reunited with his brother Elwood, a reunion that is slightly spoiled by the fact that Elwood has arrived to pick up his brother in a former police cruiser, which I guess you can forgive Jake's disappointment that he's being tooled around town in a cop car. That is, until Elwood demonstrates how much power is in the car by jumping over an open drawbridge.
Car's got a lot of pickup. It's got a cop motor, a 440 cubic inch plant. It's got cop tires, cop suspension, cop shocks. It was a model made before catalytic converters, so it'll run good on regular gas. What do you say? Is it the new Bluesmobile or what? Fix the cigarette lighter.
Now, that last comment from Jake about the cigarette lighter is hilarious because if you aren't paying attention, you might have missed just a few minutes earlier that after lighting one of his cigarettes, he tossed the lighter out of the car. The new Bluesmobile, by the way, was courtesy of 13 different vehicles, purchased from the California Highway Patrol at auction. Granted, some were designed for certain scenes, like when the Bluesmobile literally falls apart towards the end of the movie after crashing into the lobby of the Richard J. Daley Center. It took a mechanic months to rig the car for that sequence. That drawbridge was a real stunt, shot at the 95th Street Bridge that spans the Calumet River, east of the Calumet Fisheries. After showing off the impressive abilities of the new Bluesmobile, Elwood reminds his brother that he promised upon release he would visit Sister Mary Stigmata, portrayed by Kathleen Freeman of the Donna Reed Show fame. The brothers generally just call her the Penguin. She's the head of the orphanage they were both raised in, and it turns out the city is going to close the place down due to failure of paying $5,000 in property taxes. As you might imagine, Jake offers to procure the necessary funds in a rather dishonest fashion, angering Sister Mary in the process, who refuses to accept any money that isn't earned honestly. After their violent exit from Sister Mary's office, the brothers visit Curtis, who is played by Cab Calloway. And we learn he is the one that taught a young Elwood and Jake about the blues. And he is the one to set the Blues Brothers on the path of listening to a sermon by Reverend Cleophas James, played by James Brown. I've always believed Elwood was the more spiritual of the two characters, but I feel that changes when Jake is literally filled with the Holy Spirit while listening to the sermon and music number provided by James Brown. It is here where we learn that the Blues Brothers are on a mission from God to get the old band back together and to earn enough money to save the orphanage. It seems there are a few roadblocks in the way, like the fact that Elwood Blues is driving around town with a suspended license. This results in a chase through the city and through a busy shopping center. The mall that the Blues Brothers helped to demolish was actually the closed-down Dixie Square Mall in Harvey, Illinois. If I understood that documentary correctly, the shops inside the mall were set up by the companies that you see on screen, basically advertising, with the stipulation that if anything were stolen, the filmmakers would have to pay for the lost items. Apparently, this did happen, and it required a security crew to be hired to watch everything. The problem is, this team was found to be stealing even more items. So I guess another crew was hired to watch the first teams. Back to the movie. After making it out of the mall without capture, we see the tiny little apartment that Elwood calls home, right next to an elevated train line that goes by all times of the day and night. It's not the lack of sleep that Jake and Elwood need to be concerned with, but a mysterious woman who parks outside the building and uses a rocket launcher to demolish it in an attempt to end Jake's life. I guess the Blues Brothers are on a mission from on high as they miraculously survive the attack, and the police that had arrived to arrest them, thanks to that massive explosion that levels the building. The first stop for Jake and Elwood is at a local Holiday Inn, where they're able to recruit some of their past members. Steve, Donald, Murphy, Willie, and Tom agree to rejoin the Blues Brothers. But there's still the matter of convincing Matt, Alan, and Lou. The next day, the Blues Brothers happen upon a rally, one that is being held by Illinois Nazis. Their leader, humorously played by Henry Gibson of Laugh-In and the Burbs fame. This encounter puts the Blues Brothers on the list of enemies of the hate group, a fact that plays out later in the movie. Alan Rubin, it turns out, is working at a high-end restaurant as the maitre d'. All it takes for Jake and Elwood to do to get him to join them is the threat of returning every single day and night, making a public spectacle when they dine. By the way, one of the waiters in this scene is none other than Paul Rubens. Yep, Pee-wee Herman himself. Which leaves only Matt Murphy and Lou Marini for the brothers to collect. Thankfully, they both work at a soul food restaurant that just happens to be owned by Mrs. Murphy, the one and only Aretha Franklin. It's made pretty clear and quickly that Mrs. Murphy does not appreciate the Blues Brothers attempting to convince her husband to return to the life of a musician, an argument that results in the iconic Respect musical number. By the way, John Landis had Lou get up on that bar in the middle of the restaurant while that musical number is playing, knowing that on screen, all you would see are his knees while he is performing. Apparently, this wasn't told to Lou, however, who, upon seeing the film, was a little upset that it looked like it was sloppy camera work that took him out of the number. In fact, a critic failed to note this was intentional and chided Landis and the director of photography for not framing the scene properly. Oh, I almost forgot. The duo pass John Lee Hooker out in the street before they enter the restaurant. Much like with Aretha Franklin and James Brown, Hooker wasn't able to lip sync. So Landis and his crew just recorded his song, Boom Boom, out in the street. The Blues Brothers are hard to say no to, especially as they remind folks that they are on a mission from God. I feel this is evident when they are able to get much-needed instruments from Ray's Music Exchange in Calumet City, a scene that allows the fast-talking Ray Charles to show off his musical talent, with the Blues Brothers providing backup, and the folks wandering around outside on the streets to begin an amazing dance number. Jake manages to survive another attack by that mysterious woman when the phone booth he's using to line up a gig is blown up. I think I should mention that Jake and Elwood try to constantly put on a brave face about having places to play. Or maybe what I should say is, they lie through their teeth, which is especially understandable when they arrive outside of Bob's Country Bunker. Even though the sign reads the band performing is the Good Old Boys Band, Jake waves off his band members' concern that it's a simple mistake before going inside. Later that evening, when the band starts playing the Spencer Davis Group's Gimme Some Lovin', it doesn't go over well with the patrons of the rowdy bar. Thankfully, the band can fall back on the Frankie Lane version of Rawhide to begin to calm down the beer bottle chucking patrons. By the way, the Blues Brothers Band's cover of Gimme Some Lovin' actually reached number 18 on the Billboard Hot 100 when it was released as a single, with the B-side being their cover of She Caught the Katie, used at the beginning of the film. The night is a success until Jake and Elwood are presented with the bar tab, mistakenly thinking their drinks were free, and they have managed to run up quite the bill, which they obviously cannot afford. Sending the band on their way, the duo skip out on the bill just as the actual Good Old Boys Band arrives, with lead singer Tucker McElroy, played by Charles Napier, along with Jeff Morris, who plays Bob, just two more newly made enemies of the Blues Brothers. I said I was going to make this a brief synopsis. I think, as always, I've managed to fail. The Blues Brothers are running out of time, and their only shot is a one-night performance, a sold-out event that will clear the $5,000 needed to save the orphanage. After spending all day drumming up interest in their show, they're a little stunned to find that it appears the police are in the audience, waiting to swoop in and arrest them, especially since earlier during a chase, they managed to wreck a staggering amount of police vehicles who were in pursuit. I've read online that by the end of the production, they had wrecked 103 cars. Inside one of those wrecked police cruisers was Jake's parole officer, Burton Mercer, played by the still-missed John Candy, who has joined his fellow members of the law enforcement community and attended the concert. Also in attendance are Bob and the Good Ol' Boys Band. But after a number from Cab Calloway and spirited renditions of Everybody Needs Somebody to Love and Sweet Home Chicago, Jake and Elwood are afforded the opportunity to escape, stopping only to sign a recording contract with a $10,000 advance. The brothers take half and ask their new manager to pay off the $1,400 worth of IOUs to raise Music Exchange and give the rest to the members of the band. Before they can get away by way of an underground tunnel, they are once again confronted by that mysterious woman, who is now carrying a machine gun and is about to end their lives. This turns out to be Jake's fiancée, who he left at the altar, and is played by none other than Carrie Fisher. And in a hilarious scene that I personally quote to this day when I frequently mess up, Jake falls to his knees and tries to explain to his would-be executioner why he never showed up for their wedding.
You know I love you, baby. I wouldn't leave you. It wasn't my fault.
You miserable slug. You think you can talk your way out of this? You betrayed me.
No, I didn't. Honest. I ran out of gas. I had a flat tire. I didn't have enough money for cab fare. My tux didn't come back from the cleaners. An old friend came in from out of town. Someone stole my car. There was an earthquake. A terrible flood. Locust! It wasn't my fault, I swear to God!
After Jake lays a kiss on her that changes her mind, he and his brother leap into the Bluesmobile and drive for the Cook County Assessor's Office, with Illinois Nazis, the Cops, and the Good Ol' Boys Band in hot pursuit. And the Blues Brothers are able to pay the back taxes, after leading everyone on a merry chase, just in the nick of time. And seconds before they are arrested by what might possibly be every police officer in Chicago. And as the film ends, they are taken to where the film began, the Joliet Correctional Center. The band is at the very least all together as they begin to play Elvis Presley's Jailhouse Rock for their fellow inmates and ending the first Blues Brothers film. Even though, if you think about it, it's a bit of a downer that the band was arrested for the rampant destruction caused by Jake and Elwood. Being a musical, it's actually uplifting, I guess, that they are getting to do what they are supposed to do. Entertain an audience with their brand of the blues. The truth of the matter is that the Blues Brothers, as a film, really holds up. It is just as funny now as when I first saw the film at the 62 Drive-In back in 1980. It is a musical that I will revisit a couple times a year, and in all honesty, the soundtrack is in pretty heavy rotation in my house. I think that's all I really have to say about the Blues Brothers. Before I wrap up this episode of the Pop Culture Retrorama podcast, I want to apologize again about how late this show was. I'm not joking about the usual culprit being work and how it throws monkey wrenches into the free time I have to record. Although, having said that, it would help if I stopped picking a subject that requires so much research. Since this is October, I will be providing an additional mini-episode of the show closer to Halloween. This one focusing on the CBS animated show from 1980, The Drac Pack. And friends, thanks again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. I can assure you, it is much appreciated. For what it's worth, you can generally find me writing, hopefully every day, on the Pop Culture Retrorama blog. In addition to that site, I'm also writing daily on the Diary of an Arcade Employee and Saturday Frights Facebook page. If you have any comments on the podcast, or maybe suggestions for a future episode, you can contact me at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. The Pop Culture Retrorama podcast is available on iTunes and will hopefully be included on Stitcher and Spotify in the near future. If you like the show, why not help us attract new listeners by leaving us a review, a rating, and subscribing on iTunes? The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our show is courtesy of Earl Green's TheLogbook.com, kindly used with his permission. As always, I want to personally thank The Retroist, who for nearly 10 years allowed me to share my love of all things retro, including creating podcasts like this one and more. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Pop Culture Retrorama podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Universal Studios, Universal Pictures, Vanity Fair, or any of the businesses, cities, bands, and individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from the Blues Brothers and other bands are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.